everyone, I'm Brian Conley of Hunters HD Gold, and you're listening to Hunters HD Gold Behind the Lens. This podcast takes a deep dive into what it takes to be a match director, manufacturer, sponsored shooter, or just an everyday shooter trying to win his or her first major. So sit back and enjoy this episode of Hunters HD Gold Behind the Lens. Welcome back to another episode of Hunters HD Gold Behind the Lens. Today I'm sitting down in a different area, nice background here. I'm not in the van still, but I'm sitting down with Paul Pluff at the Metal Madness Shooting Sports Association. So how you doing, Paul?
I'm doing good, and I'm thrilled to be out here. I mean, it doesn't... you just look around, it doesn't get much better than this, does it?
No, not at all. It's a situation where we're... definitely relaxed. It's a nice little place in Grand Rivers, Kentucky.
Yeah.
And we'll get into that in a little bit. But, you're with Ruger.
Yeah.
And you've been with Ruger how long?
I've been going with Ruger going on 6 years now.
Okay. But you've been in the industry a lot longer. So let's back up before we even get started into all this stuff. When did you even first start, getting around firearms? Was this something you did around your dad, or is this something you just kind of went into? Or what's it look like?
I was a military brat. My dad was a career service guy, but we hunted and fished and were around firearms just about all my life.
Right.
I actually lived in Alaska for a while, so we were a big hunting and fishing family back then.
Oh, wow. Now, where'd you live at before Alaska?
I was born in Tucson, Arizona, so okay. I've spent my entire life traveling, which really served me well when I got into doing sales and marketing.
You went from Tucson to Alaska?
I went from Tucson to New Hampshire to Wisconsin to Alaska.
Okay, so they eased you into the Alaska atmosphere. Yeah, yeah. So, what was that like being in Alaska? How old were you then?
I was early teens.
Okay,
and it was just if you love the outdoors and you love fishing and hunting, I lived in Kenai, Alaska, which is Southern Peninsula.
Okay,
which is south of Anchorage, but it was absolutely wonderful place.
Really,
if you're an outdoorsman and you like to hunt and fish. It doesn't get any better than that.
Now, was that a situation where you were, hey, I'm here now, this is where I can start doing this, or were you already hunting and fishing before then?
Oh, no, we were hunting and fishing before that. It just that, when my dad got stationed up there at that time, it was just paradise.
Wow. Wow. In early teens, too. That's a pretty impressionable age.
Oh, yeah.
At that level as well. So did you have a lot of friends and stuff when you were doing all that?
We did. I mean, it is growing up military, you figure every 3 or 4 years, my dad got reassigned to different locations, which was nice. I mean, from a teenage standpoint, you start to think about, you get close friendships, but we were all military brats.
Yeah.
And so you got kind of used to having close friendships. And then in 4 years, regenerate new friendships.
Yeah, because I remember my dad, he's long passed on. He always wanted to go somewhere and put his roots somewhere.
Yeah.
You didn't really know what you didn't know because you didn't have it to miss, but did you ever feel like you didn't feel like you belonged anywhere because of that? Or I don't know. I'm asking that question because I don't know myself what that's like, because when my dad went somewhere and he planted, we were there.
Yeah.
So that's how I grew up. So
that was interesting. I think growing up in from a very young age doing mm-hmm. that, you don't think about the fact that you're missing roots.
Okay.
And for me, it kind of building my career and what I did when my dad finally retired and we had permanent roots,
right,
really is where I started my firearms industry career.
Cool.
So that worked out really well.
Where was that at when that happened?
So we were, he was in the Air Force. His last station was Westover Air Force Base in Chicopee, Massachusetts.
Okay.
And so, just down the road from there is Smith & Wesson.
Right.
And so, before I came to Ruger, I was a Smith & Wesson for 36 years.
Wow.
I started there as a gunsmith and a fitter because I was into firearms and working on them. They put me in, it was an interesting scale up for me. I got a chance to do everything and kind of work myself into position where I am today.
Right.
I started there as a gunsmith and a fitter.
So you went in with no experience at all besides just tinkering on your own personal stuff and got hired in entry level with Smith & Wesson.
Yeah. I mean, I was actually hired as a fitter, and I had some machining experience prior to that.
Right.
And it was kind of interesting because I got to the point where I was actually working on other people's gun, almost doing a gunsmithing on the side.
Okay.
I worked in a garage that was very mechanically inclined at the time.
Where'd you get your mechanical knowledge from?
I used to build cars and race them and stuff when I was a teenager.
Well, that's okay. I've talked to a lot of people who have, you know, gone from one, you know, racing cars to guns. So that's funny. Even start off with you, just that's, you know, that, was that something just as a hobby or just, you know, just having to do your own thing with cars and just kind of get into it?
It was a passion. It was a passion. I had a lot of buddies. One of my best friends' father owned a performance shop where they had a dyno and would drag race on the weekends and really got into cars then.
What was your car?
I actually had a 69 Mach 1 that had a 429 Cobra Jet in it.
That sounds like a lot.
It was. it was. I used to call it the pin me back car.
Oh, wow.
You know, and so as you think about a 17-year-old kid, we'd go to the New York to the drag strip, and it got to the point that I had to put wheelie bars. We had worked on the engine so much and got it so hyped up, and it was a car that I drove every day. But we got to where we would set it up for the strip and trailer it to the strip because I had to put wheelie bars on there. I had to put airbag suspension in there because I'd come off the line so hard that the front end would come up and just smash back down.
Now, was that technology readily available back then, based on what you're doing now? What you see now?
I think they've come a long way since back then. You know, we're talking the 70s.
Yeah, that's where I was going, because you said terminology that I hear if I'm watching a race on the weekend on TV somewhere. I hear that same terminology being used.
There again, you know, my best friend at the time, his dad was owned a performance shop that dyno with cars and stuff. So, you know, I didn't. The good news for me is that becomes a very expensive hobby, you know, and at that age, you can't afford it. But when you have a buddy whose dad does that for a living,
right?
You know, you get to borrow all the good, cool stuff and throw them on your car for the weekend.
Yep. So they say the same thing about if you have a best friend that owns a boat.
Exactly.
You don't have to own it.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So and there again, I kind of got into that, and I was doing gunsmithing on the side. So, you know, when I first got hired at Smith & Wesson, they looked at my background and stuff, and so I had an opportunity to either go into running a machine, and they quickly found out that I could work on guns and had that kind of knowledge, so they actually put me into the fitting area, actually building the guns. So I was one of the few guys there at the time that had enough experience and background working on guns. Mm-hmm. Back in the day, you were either a revolver fitter or a semi-automatic pistol fitter.
Okay.
And you didn't cross those barriers.
And where did you start?
I started out in revolvers, but quickly they had me doing both.
Really?
And so there again, as a young individual, you kind of headstrong in attitude. And so they figured the best way to deal with me is put me into management.
That's amazing.
And so they put me in charge of, one of the fitting cells at that time, fitting groups. And then I was talking about, you know, from a management standpoint, us having the ability to control, you know, the flow of both semi-automatics and revolvers and make an adjustment for whatever the demand was at the time. Mm-hmm. And so it seemed like you were either needed to build more revolvers or build more semi-automatic pistols.
Wow. See, I've talked to a lot of people that do custom guns. But you're talking more of a production line finishing area. It's not about, I guess, for being crass, it's not about how pretty it looks. It's about the function of it at that point, right?
Absolutely.
Holy cow.
And it was pretty interesting because, you know, I started looking at that and I started looking at production schedules. I started looking at distributor orders and stuff. Once again, I was one of those guys that they said I was a pain. So let's make a management.
What made you a pain?
Very vocal.
Not a bad pain, but you had an opinion.
I had an opinion, and it's one of those things that I tend to look past the here and now and start to look at things that I think could be done better. Mm-hmm. That type of stuff. And it was one of those things. And they said, well, yeah, you got a lot of great ideas, but let's put you in management so you have to deal with all those great ideas.
Okay. So you can see what it's like to say, this is a great idea, but not right now.
Yeah.
let's table that.
Yeah, exactly. And it was fortunate for me. It actually worked out very well because I started pointing out the shortfall of building to demand, they said, well, you're a smart guy. You know, if you think that's so smart, why don't you put together come up with a plan to be able to offset how we do this thing and do that.
And how old are you again?
I'm actually 63 now.
Then.
Oh, then? I was in my early 20s. I think maybe 24, 25.
With a major company.
Yeah.
And they're telling you to be in charge of this.
Yeah.
Does that go to your head or does that scare you at that age?
I wasn't. I'm not sure I was smart enough at the time to go to my head.
That's awesome.
And so I took on the challenge.
Yeah.
And so for the first time in the history of Smith & Wesson, I had an integrated group of guys that I sat and trained. So they both, you know, because there again, it was a specialty type thing. You either built revolvers or you built semi-automatic pistols. And so I put together a group of 15 individuals that had the skill set to be proficient with both.
All right. Because that opens, I've been in corporate for a while myself, and you're definitely corporate at that point.
Yeah.
You have a lot of people, supervisors that have been in the business a long time, and you're running around in your early 20s with a team of 15.
Yeah.
What did that look like for the people that had been there a lot longer? I mean, were you accepted there, or they were set, or did they think they were setting you up to fail? Because that's when you're a young buck, you know, 20 nothing year old kid that's in charge of a team of a corporation that's been around for ages making, and now you're in charge of production. There's got to be some pushback you may have had back then, right?
I think there was. I was fortunate. I just approached life different. So as supervisors, a lot of guys were that hardcore, you know, you do it my way or hit the highway.
100%.
And then there was guys that probably didn't step up and handle people the way they should have, and things fell apart. And I looked at it, and one of the things I had to deal with my career quite a bit, Smith & Wesson, is I always had to take on the problem child because, and I say that because there were guys that people consider problem child because there again, they were kind of like what I was, you know, very, very headstrong, boisterous, you know, opinionated. Mm-hmm. And so some of the supervisors, you know, instead of dealing with it, just let it go and said, there's a problem. We got to get rid of them. They'd come to me. And so my approach was, is everybody has a value until they prove they don't.
Okay. I love that.
And what I discovered early on that built me up through my career and served me well, you know, in the management style is understand that individual, tapping into what they're good at versus what they're not good at.
Kind of like find out what their hot buttons were.
Find out what their hot buttons were and find out what the skill set was and put them in a position to succeed. Because one of the things I found out early on, it's not so much about, for people, especially, you know, the people I was dealing with, it was not so much about how much they can make. It was more than the paycheck. Everybody wants to feel accomplished in what they do.
Okay.
And so when I would take these guys and figure out, you know, who were deemed problem child, and I'd find out what they're good with, and I just add that responsibility so that they could rise to the top.
Right.
And some of the people that were initially looked at as being problem child turned out to be some of the best employees I had.
Wow.
Just because I afforded them that opportunity to succeed.
And when you take somebody like that, and then you carve them into what they're successful at, they become very loyal.
Absolutely.
To you. Well, I mean, you're building a team of like loyalty.
Yep.
And a lot of people don't understand that. When you get somebody who you've taken a chance on, and you gave them that extra, you know, motivation and extra support, they'll do anything for you at that point, right?
Oh, they will. And you're right. They're extremely loyal. And so it was never, I actually got to the point by working with my people doing that. It was never that I had to look out for the bad guy. You know, it seemed like before I transitioned to my next phase of career, you know, in management, it was more like those guys, every day I'd come in and not worry about it because I knew they were looking to make me look good.
Mm-hmm.
And to the point that it was kind of interesting. I talked about that group of guys that I molded into being able to do both pistols and revolvers.
Right.
So at the time, they were moving me from there to be in charge of customer service because of my technical knowledge and stuff.
That's a big jump.
Yeah, I had customer service underneath me when I was at Smith & Wesson for 25 years.
Right.
Even when I was doing the marketing and sales stuff, it all reported to me because kind of my background.
Right.
But that was the first opportunity. I had these guys trained so well. And there again, hand them responsibility. I had them responsible for tracking quality, scheduling, ordering, you know, what the next thing. And so I actually rotated and put guys in charge of that almost every other week to become where
cross-training, and you're cross-training and developing.
Yeah.
So that's cute.
Beyond,
that's cool.
Beyond their normal, you have to put a gun together type of thing.
Out of their comfort zone to challenge them.
Yeah. And they all rose to the occasion. So when I left that fitting group to move to focus 100% on thing, they became the first self-directed work cell within Smith & Wesson.
Really?
Yeah. Because they had all the skill sets to handle it from A to B running that.
Did you help write the SOP, standard operating procedures, for that department?
I did.
Okay.
I did.
Because there's got to be somebody to leave that behind of A, B, and C. That's why I asked that question.
Yeah. So as we did that, as I developed it, you know, and we had quality standards and we had all that stuff. As we developed that, we documented it all. Wow. And we documented it as a group.
And this is still back in the late 70s, early 80s.
Yep.
Wow. Way ahead of the time of what we see today that people roll out. Where did it start? Well, this started back, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a guy's initials on this that's been around for a while.
Yeah. It was kind of interesting because, I mean, that had, you know, the old mentality was, you know, rule them with the iron fist. And I changed that mentality because I've got these guys to step up, to take on that responsibility. And they felt really good about themselves.
So. Well, let's think about the history of Smith & Wesson or any gun company that works with metal. You know, they've gone through different situations in their, as a company, making things for this company, making this. And all of a sudden, there may be a conflict that happens somewhere else. And all of a sudden, they need help making stuff for conflicts and everything changes. So they're used to driving people because we no more long about we're trying to help the country,
right?
Not help our pocketbooks anymore, because everybody got together at different times before they got into the 70s and 80s. So there's a mentality that was there from the old regime.
Yeah.
That's all they did was, you know, we don't care if it looks like that, get it out. They got to have it. You know, they got to have it.
Yeah. And it was kind of interesting because I focused with the groups that I had. We focused extremely tight on quality. They become and so you got to understand, back in those days, today everything is run kind of on an hourly or salary basis.
Right.
Back then, we're still in the age of piecework.
Yep.
So it was about you got paid by the piece. Mm-hmm. So that was always a recipe for poor quality.
Yep.
And so, you know, having that and having a group, you know, how do you kind of, change that mentality that instead of vying for who's makes the most that day, mm-hmm. who makes the highest quality. So one of the things we started doing is daily, and I had there again, I used to rotate the guys around to be in charge of doing that.
Right.
We would post, you know, and I thought about it because it was an issue back during those days, mm-hmm. you know, because I started tracking quality and it was an issue. And so how do you deal with that? And I said, well, there's right now with piecework, everybody's bragging, right? It says, you know, I built 10 more guns than you did today. Mm-hmm. So how do I turn that around? And I'm good with them build 10 more guns than the other guy because we have to meet the numbers.
Yeah.
But I have to have them top quality. So we started posting acceptance rates.
Yeah, because when you catch somebody, let's say somebody did 10 guns more than everybody else, and then you go back and evaluate those 10 guns, it's not easy to go back to a guy and say, hey, this is not to spec, or not spec is not the right word, but not, this is not clean.
Right.
This is not our standards. And machinists and guys usually don't want to hear that. That's usually, you know, you start treading on people's pride at that point.
You do. And that's one of the things, and you stop and think about, you know, the whole concept of fitting a gun. Mm-hmm. It becomes a thing that's self-pride. You take pride in ownership, pride in quality. And so there again, I had to make the numbers, but also, you know, one of the things that I also knew that is if I sent the gun through inspection or into the range that failed, it was coming back. Mm-hmm. And me as a department had to deal with that. I had to be repaired. It had to be good before it went out the door.
Yeah.
And so I had to get my return rate for repairs. I had to get that return rate down to a level that was manageable and continue to produce the quantity I wanted. So we started posting, everybody's daily quality acceptance rates.
Right.
We broke it down to accepted percentages. And then because I had the guys tracking that, doing that, and it became a thing about the pride became in, you know, I had 100% acceptance rates. Would you have?
Exactly.
And
you could reward on that as well.
You could. And I just allowed peer pressure to change the mentality of what they were doing.
And the supervisors at the time over your people you had to, you know, answer to, were they like, good luck with that? Or were they like, okay, because, you know, it's hard to change that old guy in there. So.
And they were. It was very skeptical at first and until the results started showing.
Right.
Because, I mean, is one of the things I did, you know, running the group is I tracked, you know, not only our numbers every day, you know, to make the donut, so to speak.
Right.
But also the quality, the return rate. And it's kind of funny because when you stop and think, and it's no different than anything else, when the acceptance rate, first time through acceptance rate starts to really go up, you would think that would have, because they're so focused on quality, you would think that would have an adverse effect on the quantity that you're putting out on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. And it was just the opposite because I wasn't having to deal with the returns.
That's it.
And so it not only we have a better gun going out, but I was meeting the numbers or exceeding the numbers that they were expecting to be produced because of that.
You turn your maintenance repair shop into like the Maytag repairman waiting on work to do.
Right. Well,
that's a good thing.
Well, the start of that is and you hit another thing. So when I first started doing the groups, they had the core group of fitters per se, and then they had, you know, you had your inspectors and range guys, and then they had a group of people that were just trying to do repairs.
Okay.
And so it was piecework at the time, and I let everybody know that said, hey, you know, here's the, you know, we had industrial engineers that would actually go through there and do a step-by-step procedure on that with timing and stuff to get the piecework rate. And it was from A to Z, like pick up file, move it 6 inches, you know, that type of thing. And so when I kind of put these guys together, I rounded them up and I took out these sheets and I let them hold them up and let them drop to the floor because it was old dot matrix at the time, you know, printer.
Right. Oh, yes, sir.
And I said, hey, guys, this is what you're getting paid for. You know, starting today, this is your responsibility. So I'm eliminating our repair department. They're going to start fitting. I'm going to start training those guys to be fitters. And so anything that comes out of the range or back from inspection will go back to the original guy that fit it. And you're going to be responsible for doing that repair.
I love that.
Because you got paid for it.
Yeah.
So at first they hated it. But
as an owner, I love that. Yeah. You hold people accountable real quick.
Oh, and it did. And then I started working on how do I change your attitude? And that's when we started getting into tracking quality performance versus quantity performance.
And you did that part at Smith & Wesson for how many years?
Well, I was at Smith & Wesson for 36 years.
But
that part of it, yeah. I probably did it for about 8 years before they moved me in charge of customer service. Right. And I was also in charge of warranty centers. That's when I really started doing a lot of my international traveling, going around
training at warranty centers. Customer service at a gun manufacturer.
Yeah.
That sounds, you know, I know what customer service is like just selling lenses.
Yeah.
When you start talking about that many moving parts and everything else, that had to be almost entertaining at some point, right? Because there's a lot of different calls you're going to get that just like, I can't imagine what customer service, explain what that would look like when you first got there.
It was like,
I see that, but I don't want the people listening to go.
It's an eye opener. and so, you know, the reality is going from manufacturing to customer service is like, oh my God, I wish I had done some stuff earlier than what I did because now I'm paying the price for it. You know, customers, and I used to tell the people that answered the phone, and I had a group of repair guys that worked directly for me and stuff that did that. I used to tell the people on the phone, I said, you know, really like what you're doing because this is going to be the only job that you get paid to get yelled at.
Exactly. And overcome objections really fast because 9 times out of 10, a phone call that comes in, you just have to listen.
Yeah.
And sometimes they can actually talk themselves in the solution, but you just got to let them listen. You just got
to
listen.
And you bring up a valid point, and that's very intuitive to you because, I mean, all the years I did customer service, I can't tell you how many times, especially if I had a new person come in, that you had to walk them through how to deal with a customer because you can't take it personally.
Right.
You can't because it will burn you out so fast and you can't argue with the customer. You know that.
Just got to listen.
And sometimes I'll tell them when the guy goes off and starts ranting, I don't care what they're saying to you. Just let them rant. If it takes 10 minutes, they have to say what they got to say.
That's right.
They're angry.
That's right.
And you'll just let them drone on for as long as it takes. And when they take that breath and they're done, you fixed the problem.
Yep.
And if you try to fix their problem before they're done, first of all, you're on the phone twice as long.
Yep.
And the outcome never is good. So you hit the nail on the head. I mean, you gotta let somebody who's having a problem vent, then fix their problem.
That's exactly right. So you went from customer service, then into marketing.
Yeah, they had me, brought me up, and I started the authorized dealer program, working with all the dealers across the United States, setting up authorized dealers.
Oh, so you're responsible for that terminology.
Yes. Yes, actually. So. And so we put together that program and stuff, obviously working with sales a lot. And then I also started, we had external sales where our guys travel around, and I wanted to get more hands-on with the dealers, because when you're traveling the territory, you can only... you know, time between dealer to dealer, you can only touch and feel so many dealers at a time. So I actually kind of went to a program where I had about four people that worked underneath me.
Okay.
That would actually go through the list of all of our authorized dealers and just reach out on a daily basis. How's it going? Can I explain anything? Do you know about a new product? That type of stuff.
Right.
Just to continue the touch and feel type of thing.
Wow. With Smith & Wesson, did you get into the competition side with them?
I did.
Okay. It's,
so, interesting enough. So, for me, I went from that, and then I kind of went into as a director of sales.
Okay.
So, I ran the sales side of it, and then they moved me into sales and marketing. At that point in time, when I went into marketing, that's when I took over the Smith & Wesson shooting team.
Really?
So, I had the Jerry Mikulicz of the world.
Yeah.
And,
Were you responsible for getting that started, or was that established?
It was somewhat established, but it was kind of chaotic. It was haphazard. So we had, you know, at that time, our Smith & Wesson Performance Center custom shop. Mm-hmm. They had a few guys on staff, and then you had some other folks that were wearing jerseys that weren't. And so when I kind of stepped in, I was getting calls and complaints about some of the shooters and shooters' attitudes, and I go, well, wait a minute, I don't even know who this person is. Mm-hmm. And so when I started digging into it, it was so informal at the time, outside of guys like, you know, Jerry Mikulicz, and we had Tommy Campbell, you know, some of the big boys, and Brian Enos, and, you know, you had that stable that was really good, but we had 70-some-odd other shooters.
70?
Oh, it was insane.
And what year was this?
This was mid to late 80s.
So this is back when, you know, IPSC, USPSA, everything was just getting started. And you 70.
Yeah, 70 shooters because
guys were... Was there anybody left?
No, I mean, it was...
Holy cow.
It was crazy because they were just handing out, you know, letting people put, you know, Smith & Wesson logos on there and calling themselves shooter because they were shooting a Smith & Wesson handgun. But it was just out of hand. So, you know, after about a month and a half of that and listening to people, I said, well, time out. I said, yeah, this is totally uncontrollable. This is not a team. This is a free for all.
Yeah.
And so outside of the big boys that I had on there, I just cut everybody.
Right.
And we developed contracts for the shooters. And here's code of conducts. Here's all this other stuff. And so we developed that. And so my focus was going to be, and it's great. I mean, you want everybody shooting your product, just like you want everybody wearing your glasses. But you do need to become the point that once you establish that relationship that you're calling them a team member and they're putting on that logo jersey, they are now part of the company.
Yes, they represent the company. You're exactly right.
Yeah.
Let me take a quick break. This is one of our sponsors. Because I want to get into this couple of questions, but we got to get into a lot of stuff what we're doing now as well. But the history is what's really got me intrigued. So thank you so much for sharing that.
No problem.
This is one of our sponsors real quick.
This week's podcast is brought to you by Kona Gold. Kona Gold is a premier lifestyle brand for those who work hard and play harder. There are many hemp companies out there that get lost in the crowd, but Kona Gold sets the gold standard with its premier line of products. When traveling all around with a Magical Mystery Tour to different matches, I travel around with lots of different flavors, including pink grapefruit, candy apple, and vanilla cherry. Make sure to stop by and get some for yourself. They are all zero calories, zero sugar, use organic hemp, and are THC and CBD free. Competitive shooters love them because there's no shakes, no headaches, and no crash. When you order from ConaGoldHemp.com, make sure to use discount code HUNTERSHD for another 20% off.
So you're in this, you brought up a name a while ago, Jerry Mikulicz, of course. Were you with him when he broke some broke some of the world records and stuff like that? Were you
yeah,
standing there on the line with them when that happened?
For several of them. Yes,
really?
Yeah. And Jerry's just an amazing guy. I used to tell everybody, and he's about as down to earth as you can get.
Yes. Yes.
And so it's kind of funny. So each shooter has its own personality.
Right.
And Jerry almost seemed quiet, reserved, but he was so down to earth. Jerry's one of those guys. And I just remember the first time I really started trying to shoot revolvers, and revolvers can be very frustrating. I love shooting revolvers. My wife loves shooting revolvers.
Right.
But Jerry, you know, most guys, they're so competitive. They see you doing something wrong, and they let you do something wrong because they're there to win.
Right.
Jerry's just the opposite. He'll walk over and give you, hey, you know, if you change your grip and do this and this and this, mm-hmm. so you can have better control and better accuracy on it.
Now, let me ask you this question, though, because there's another side of that. Jerry was so fast. Was he a nightmare for the people trying to build his gun to make it work that way? Or is it something that you'd have to do? Because when you have somebody that fast and how they were doing things with his thumb and everything and his trigger and everything else he was doing, he could be pretty hard on a manufacturing team, can he?
Well, you got to keep in mind. So part of having a shooting team,
yeah,
they're your test bed.
Okay.
So you can do all the testing you want.
Right.
You put your product in the hands of a professional shooter or a guy that's putting millions of rounds down range every year.
Right.
He's gonna prove out the product for you. And he helps you when he breaks something, makes a better product.
When you have somebody like that break a record, though, and you have somebody else go buy this revolver and he can't be as fast, that can be a customer service nightmare as well, because what are we doing that he's not doing?
So. I tell everybody, I mean, Jerry's the one of the most pleasant human beings on the face of the earth to deal with.
Yes. Stuff,
and his whole family is. But at the end of the day, you look at that man's trigger finger, he's a machine.
Okay.
I mean, that guy can...
We sold you the gun. We can't sell you his finger.
Yeah. And that's the reality of it. You know, guys like him, guys like Doug, guys like, you know, Enos, mm-hmm. and Brian and Plasko and all those guys, big shooters back then.
Right.
They rose to the top because they were so focused. And they're a fine-tuned machine.
When you were there watching that break a world record, for an example, or seeing stuff happen, did you realize that you were... You know, in that moment, did you realize you were seeing the future of greatness, or do you just realize it's just another day at the rank? What, you know, because you don't realize, you know what Jerry Mitchell is now,
yeah.
You know, 20 years later, but you're going back at that time, you're like, somebody else is going to come beat this. Or, you know, was that even a thought process? So
you got to stop and think about the guys like Doug Koenig.
Yeah.
Doug's now at
Legends.
Doug's at now 20 Bianchi Cup
yep.
wins.
Yep.
Jerry kind of hung up his. Jerry still shoots revolvers.
Yes.
Jerry, you know, the IRC, International Revolver Championship, yep. Jerry had 23 of them.
Exactly.
And so even early on, you watch those guys, and you knew you were watching greatness.
Okay.
You know, they were so focused. Each one of them had a different personality.
Right.
But they were all so focused. They were truly tuned athletes.
Right.
And so, you know... If you sit back and you watch those guys, you watch them practice, you watch them compete, even when they're setting records and stuff, you quickly come to that conclusion that these guys are just tuned athletes.
Wow.
They're just amazing. So as you watch that, you know, and listen, I love to shoot, but I first person to tell you that I'm not that, you know, award-winning shooter.
Right.
I mean, that's a talent. That's a focus. That's
a whole nother dedication.
It's dedication. And you just know when you're around those guys and you watch them, mm-hmm. You know, even when they're early on in their career, you know that you're witnessing greatness.
Wow. Well, you did the shooting team. You started getting to know a lot of people, I guess, in the shooting sports at that point. You know, 36 years, is that was when you were at the top level of Ruger before you left, is that what you were in charge of, was the marketing and shooting, or what did you
do? Yeah, marketing, okay. Shooting, and public relations, media relations, okay. Advertising, kind of handled... I tell everyone my career at Smith & Wesson, when I was there, the only thing that wasn't on my resume was sweeping the floor, but every once in a while they made me do it.
Of course you did. Of course you did. Now, so you worked for a company 36 years, and were you at a point where you wanted to just retire, or was it a situation where, you know, there's a different level of comfort zone when you think about leaving somewhere for 36 years.
Yeah. And I went through at Smith & Wesson, I went through a lot of management changes. And yeah. Every time somebody new came in, you had to you justify what you were doing. You know, even the shooting programs, you know, most people come on, especially when you have people coming in that are come from big brand names, but outside the firearm industry.
Right.
So they don't understand the concept of, you know, what shooting and shooting teams bring to the, to the table. So you have to, every time I'd have to restart and re-justify it and get them back on board. And it gets to the point that, you know, you start to lose it. And at that time, I made a decision to move. I needed to do it for myself. And I had also gone through some personal stuff. I had lost a wife in a car accident.
Oh, wow.
And who I adored. My daughter got, about a year later, my daughter got in a severe car accident, traumatic brain injury. So I had to take a legal guardianship of her and my two grandkids. So my life was a little different. And so my ability to play politics and my ability to be more forgiving got shorter. And one of the things I remember at one time I had at the peak, I had 75 people that were direct reports to me.
Yeah.
And so, but one of the things I used to tell somebody when I'd hire them was, hey, I want to hire you, but make sure this is really what you want to do, that you love this, doing what you want to do. I said, because we spend more time at work than we do at home. And when you're miserable at work, it affects your home life and it makes your whole entire life come unglued.
Yes.
I said, so what I want you to know is the day you get up and have a knot in your stomach to go to work, it's time to fire your boss and move on. And I got to that point with all the stuff that was happening in my life and just not having the patience per se. I needed a fresh start.
Well, you realized going through those traumatic situations has to be an eye-opening of it. Like, why are you doing this?
Yeah. So. And for me, what drove me all those years to go from where I was to what it was is just that passion, just that excitement to go to work every day and do that. And at the end, I had lost, I think the last 4 years that I was there, I had totally lost that.
Right.
And I had to be honest with myself when I looked in the mirror. I said, you know, you've lost that drive and passion. It's time to move on.
Based on the politics of working for any major corporation like that, I can definitely understand that. Did you think you ever wanted out of the firearm industry, or did you just want to change brands?
That was, I mean, I grew up in the firearms industry. I got offers. I got offers from a company outside the firearms industry.
Right.
And I talked about my wife that I lost in a car accident. She was very astute. I remember one time when I was running customer service, and I had became, there were several articles written about Smith & Wesson's customer service. And I had a dental tool company out of Rhode Island call me up and made me an offer that was more than twice my current salary.
Right.
And relocate me close to the coast.
Wow.
In Rhode Island. And so I did what every good husband should do. I went back and I say, hey, listen, I got this offer. It's a lot more money. And my wife loved the beach. We'll be close to the coast. They'll relocate us. She goes, well, what'd you tell him? I said, well, I asked him to give me a couple of weeks to think through that because it was more than just my decision. She goes, okay. So I'll go back into work. About 4 days later, she called me at work, which she never did. She, you know, she worked in HR.
Right.
So she had this thing about not interrupting you at work.
Right.
She called me at work. So I thought something really, and she, I picked up the phone and I said, hey, what's up? She goes, listen, I thought about that. She goes, you really love what you're doing. She says, sometimes I think you love what you're doing more than you love me. And I said, wait a minute, baby. She goes, no, seriously, you love what you're doing.
Yes.
And she says, so just so we understand each other, she says, we do that. You make that move. He says, I know within a year you're going to be miserable. And just so you understand, I'm not living with miserable. And she hung up the phone.
I'm not living with miserable. Wow.
And so it was, I went, wow. And 2 days later, the company called me back and I turned down the job because I thought through what she said.
Right.
Yeah. Once you're in this industry, and you get this now.
I do now.
It's a passion. It
almost becomes a responsibility.
Yeah.
And I take that. And what I mean by that is, you know, now especially because, you know, with the Second Amendment being under attack constantly. Yeah. Now, back when you were working at Smith & Wesson, was there a lot of attacks going on with the Second Amendment?
There was. I mean, yeah, we're always focused on the here and now.
Right.
But I can't tell you, I mean, if you put this thing and you were chart out the history of all that.
Yeah.
it you get the, and it usually changes with the political climate.
Of course it does.
And so it's been around for a while.
But you've seen things go from pocket pistols being everyday life for everybody to certain states not even allowing it anymore, certain cities not even allowing it anymore. And then you're in a situation where, unfortunately, the mental health has gone to shit, for lack of better words, and nobody cares about them anymore, which is really sad. To now we're under heavy, heavy attack because of that, but they're not addressing the issues. Have you ever had to do anything with the Second Amendment, talking to
so
politicians and stuff like that, for your understanding?
Yeah, I mean, actually, I got involved with the NSSF. They were using me from the legal side. So when they were doing the heavy push on all the micro stamping, and stuff, I went and testified in front of several Senate hearing committees. Around the states when they were trying to push it state by state. California was my first endeavor, and we totally, I mean, they end up passing the law, which really kind of, that's why California doesn't have access to a lot of the products that they should. But it's kind of interesting. I looked at it and I learned, and California was an eye opener for me. So I went in there and I started to testify. And so you kind of have this sheet in front of you, you start to give the speech. What I didn't know about that stuff at the time is they hold you a time limit. And it was like three and a half minutes. Mm-hmm. And when the time limit got off, they would either let you continue or they shut you off. And so when you're dealing with a bunch of politicians who are anti-gun to begin with.
Well, there's you know, the word is hate. They don't like you. Yeah. They hate you.
So they shut me off, and I went, okay. So I just spent all that stuff to introduce myself. First of all, I told them who I was and where I was from. That instantly, they were looking for that clock to go off so they could shut me off. I said, okay, I got to change how we do this. So the next one I went to, I thought about it. And it was kind of interesting because this guy that was pushing the micro stamp, and it was a truly at that time, it was a sole source product. Nobody else was doing the micro stamping.
Right.
But understanding the micro stamping on the firing pins, I did a bunch of research on it. And then I called up the guy that was pushing that, the guy that owned the company. I said, hey, I said, if I send you a bunch of firing pins, I told him who I was, do you think you could do micro stamp on, just put some stuff just so we can evaluate it?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't lie. We were going to evaluate it.
Right.
And he sent me about 30 firing pins. And I started thinking about it. And so the next one I went into, I had a bunch of spent 9mm cases. And if you look at on a semi-automatic, that is a lock breech. So when that slide starts coming back, that barrel starts to drop. Mm-hmm. So if you look closely at a spent firing, spent casing on there, what we used to call primer swipe, it almost looks like a teardrop.
Yeah.
Because that firing pin hasn't totally exited as it's coming down and it's dragging.
That's right.
And so I sent that in there with a picture, and I walked in there and I sent around a firing pin and told them with a magnifying glass, look at the tip of that, and you can see the markings on there. And I said, I want you to look at, you know, the pictures of spent case, because you can't bring even a spent case. And I said, and I explained the firing pin swipe and what the gun's doing at the time. And I started explaining to them, you know, and if you do your research, the average gun used in crime is 10 years old or plus. I mean, that's just the stats on it. And so, which they have several rounds to it. I said, so you've seen that, you've seen the primer swipe, and it came back around. Then I'd pass around. When I'd go in there, I'd purposely get in early. I'd go to the nearest Lowe's, Home Depot, or whatever hardware store, mm-hmm. and I'd get a fine stone, a rough stone, and a cheap file. And I had these firing pins. So I passed the firing pin around, and I didn't get into any speeches. I wanted to explain to them why they would spend a lot of money and this would totally fail after explaining that. So the firing pin come back around, and I take the least aggressive thing I had was a stone, and I like swipe it three times across the tip of the firing pin. I pass it around. I said, take a good look at what you see.
It's gone.
It's gone. I said, so how easy do you think it's going to be for somebody to overcome that? But let's take that aside. I said, first of all, the average gun is 10 years old, mm-hmm. used in a crime. So at what point in time does doing this become effective as far as, you know, going after those individuals. And by the way, the individuals using them don't have the guns registered. So
no, it's the criminals are criminals.
And so after the California thing, you know, that was the only state that passed micro stamping.
Holy cow. Wow. So 36 years with this, with Smith & Wesson, and all of a sudden Ruger
Yes.
Shows up. They called you or just an opening, you know, without getting into any details.
This is a small industry. So
it is. Everybody knows everybody.
Everybody knows everybody. I have close friends at SIG, close friends at Glock, mm-hmm. close friends at Ruger and stuff. And I had to take a step back and said, you know, where do I want to finish my career? And I looked at Ruger. I looked at what Ruger was doing. Mm-hmm. And I looked at Ruger being on the march. I mean, Ruger went from being, the 22s and the hunting rifles. They were building 1911s. They got into the AR lines. I just seen this company that was getting extremely innovative.
Okay.
And a good company. They had good quality reputation. In the scheme of things from the sell side, you know, they were the guys with the white hats. They did everything right. They didn't pull any backdoor type of things, you know, because I used to deal with a lot of distributors and stuff. And so they had that reputation.
Right.
And it's really, really, really where I wanted to be. And so I kind of went to them.
Really? Was this like a SHOT Show thing or just out of the blue? Or
no, I contacted them. So, after I left Smith & Wesson, I had the opportunity because of my daughter and stuff. There was a one-year gap between me and Ruger.
Okay.
Because I was taking care of stuff. I had to deal with my daughter with her brain injury and all that stuff. And so I had, doing what I do, I'm very busy. I spend a lot of time on the road, and I still do.
Yep.
But I needed to focus to get things kind of moving in the right direction, mm-hmm. For my grandkids and for my daughter. So I was afforded that opportunity, which is great. But I kind of knew where I wanted to go, and I had offers from other companies, but I had made a decision where I wanted to go because mm-hmm. it's the company. When I sat back and I looked at it, looked at the reputation and understanding, the environment I came from and the environment that I wanted to go to, mm-hmm. I had kind of targeted that and I kind of really pushed. And so I'm a public relations manager for Ruger. So the guy that was there, who I was also friends with, because he worked at Smith. Everybody worked at Smith.
Now, is that what you were hired in as a public relations?
Yep.
Continue.
And so I got hired. He had to retire. His wife had some health issues and stuff. And so at that time I was looking, it opened the door for me there. Mm-hmm. And I was really... It's really where I wanted to go. I mean, it's a great company. The individuals there are just outstanding. They're more concerned with quality and what the customer wants than mm-hmm. anything else. And so I made up my mind. That's really where I wanted to be. So I got very fortunate the fact that that door opened for me.
All right.
And so I got in there and it's been pretty cool because getting in there, and doing that, so my background, it opened some doors to have the company do some stuff that they never did before.
Like what?
Ruger never really had a formal shooting team. They never got deeply involved with the competitive shooting.
So you're responsible for the Ruger shooting team even being started?
Yeah.
Well, that's wonderful. Tell me what that was like going to the EVPs to find out, an idea.
So it's kind of interesting. Chris Colloy, who is the president and CEO, and believe it or not, Chris at one time worked for Smith & Wesson, I worked for.
Okay. Funny you said everybody worked at Smith & Wesson at one time or another. But
it's a small community.
Okay, got it.
You look at Tom Taylor at SIG.
Yeah.
He worked there. Tony Morrison, who used to run Taurus.
Okay.
Used to be a sales guy. Okay. So I can walk through the industry and we all walk into the same room and we're right. shaking hands and patting bats because, we all at one time either worked for each other or worked with each other.
It's like growing up together in the same high school.
And so... And it's great. It's part of why you don't want to leave the industry once you mm-hmm. get in.
Right.
But he actually came to me and said, listen, Paul, he says, I know we've never done a shooting team before. He said, but I got to be honest with you. We never had anybody that knew how to manage one.
Right.
So you got that experience. I'm just going to leave it up to you.
So I love this because I'm thinking in my mind, okay, you're going from somebody don't have a shooting team and you're thinking to yourself, all right. Who's a free agent? who do I go to be the captain of the Ruger shooting team?
We were at the NRA show.
Okay.
We were at the NRA show, and it was my first NRA show with Ruger.
And what year was this?
Uh, well, going on 6 years ago.
Okay, so, continue.
And so the guy that I was going to be reporting to, who's the VP of marketing, says, and they started talking about it, and Chris was talking about it, and said it to me in front of him. He goes, yeah. He goes, I'm not sure how that's going to go. He says, man, if you could get somebody like that Doug Koenig guy, he goes, he said, you know, then we might have something. I go, seriously? He goes, yeah. So I dial up. I says, hey, Doug, what are you doing? He goes, well, I'm at Safariland. I'm doing a demo right now. I said, oh, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but could you do me a favor? I said, you got time after that demo to swing by the Boogaloo booth and see me? He goes, oh, anything for you. So he does his demo. It comes over there. I take him in the back room. And so now Chris and my boss is there, Rob. And I said, so, Doug, we're thinking about doing a shooting team. And I know you're still under contract with Ruger. I said, but would you come shoot for me again?
You're under contract with Smith & Wesson. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And he goes, well, yeah, absolutely. And I looked at him. I said, I guess we got a team. And then you look at who I got. So Randy Rogers, you should shoot for me there.
Yeah.
I called up Randy. And she said, absolutely. And then I called up Dave Ojaso, who is winning everything.
Yeah, Dave's awesome.
Dave's awesome. Dave introduced me to James McGinty, who is just winning everything.
Yes.
And McGinty was kind of an interesting individual. So Dave's telling me about this kid that he's been mentoring since he's 16. And so I go to an IRC, International Revolver Championship. And so, because I came in, and so Smith kind of owned that
right
for umpteen years. IRC was, it was a Smith & Wesson match. 98% okay. of the shooters were shooting Smith. And so I come in, and after I left Smith, nobody was focusing on that. So I said, well, okay, it's kind of like buying a new house. You know, sometimes you got to tear it apart and rebuild that type of thing. So I took over the title sponsorship of the IRC and I-Corp.
Wow.
And so I go to the match because I'm going to be giving away the awards and stuff. And so I'm sitting there, and Dave says, yeah, I said, this is, you know, see that kid up there, you know, James, you know, he's the kid I've been mentoring. So this kid takes and he shoots, and he just blows everybody away. He wins the limited division. I go, wow, that's pretty impressive. And Dave says, this is his first revolver match.
Wow.
I go, what? He goes, yeah, this is first. He's really a pistol shooter, but this is his first revolver match. And right. So the kid wins the division. Yeah. And so I went, so James, I said, how you do? My name is Paul Plouffe. You know, Dave told me about it. Come with me. We need to have a talk.
Exactly. Exactly.
So that's how we ended up on there. And it kind of got to the point. I mean, I was starting up a team. Obviously, it's going to be a limited budget because they had not done that. So
right.
I would have loved to chase Jerry down, and even Julie Golov, who shot for me. I actually brought Julie and Randy both from Glock. I stole them from Glock. So right. I talked to Ed Fitzgerald at Glock. It's that funny. I always tell the guy, I always turn around to him and say, who am I going to steal next?
I was curious. Did you ever get any phone calls from Smith & Wesson? Like, what are you doing? When this was happening,
well,
because you're still friends with everybody,
I am.
You can't. So you got people going, Paul,
yeah.
Please tell me your next move so we can at least try to negotiate something.
So I did get that phone call, and they said, well, you know, the president at the time said, man, he's kind of pissed. I can't believe you're doing that. And I go, well, just give him a hint that if he didn't make it so easy, it probably wouldn't be happening.
Make it so easy. I got it. Well, let's take one last break. This is for our last sponsors, and I'd like to get into what we're doing now with Ruger.
Absolutely.
And what we're getting into for the future. I'm excited about that.
This week's podcast is also sponsored by Make Ready Nutrition. They have three products available for shooters that are 2-Alpha Performance to drink before hammer down, 2-Alpha Recovery that I use personally as a meal replacement for lunch with 34 grams of protein and is low carb, 2-Alpha Ammunition, which is next level hydration plus energy and amino acids for shooters, gym workouts, or pushing your body in sports and recreation. Whether you're in the Texas heat or in Arizona desert, 2-Alpha Ammunition works harder and endures longer. This unique formula is manufactured for shooters by shooters to replenish your body with electrolytes and hydration while helping aid in muscle recovery and providing fast energy. For 25% off your next order, go to makereadynutrition.com/discount/huntershd or enter huntershd at checkout for 25% off your entire order. makereadynutrition.com. Are you ready?
So you're in a situation where you're doing the shooting team. Everything's starting to happen. You're starting to get new guns from Ruger into competition hands. Was there a gap there of where they needed to improve with some of the products to make them competition ready at that point? Or what did that look like with all the new shooters in competition shooting Ruger guns?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. So, you know, for me, I was point blank, it was a great move for me.
Okay.
Going to Ruger. Because one of the things when I mentioned that, you know, you kind of get to that point where you're not excited about being at work anymore.
Yeah.
And that's what drives me. And going to Ruger, afforded me to really get back to enjoying what I'm doing and just getting stoked and exciting, because that's what drives me.
Right.
And it's kind of interesting because one of the things I ran into when I was at Smith is getting the engineers and stuff sit down with my shooters who are putting millions of rounds mm-hmm. through these guns and take their assessment on doing stuff. Ruger is absolutely wide open to that.
Nice.
You know, the whole concept of the Ruger Custom Shop,
mm-hmm.
which they never really did before, came about that. And I just remembered the first guns we did, the Super GP, the 1911s, the stuff out of the custom shop. You get on the phone and says, okay, well, we're going to do this. What needs to be? And it was conference calls with the product managers, engineers, and the shooting team
mm-hmm.
that says, guys, if we're going to do this, this is what we're looking for, A, B, and C type of thing. And so they were taking the input from the shooters to help with the development of it. And to me, that just gets me so excited because it's real world.
Mm-hmm.
It's how do you, it's not sending a product out there, then that guy having to completely strip it down, tune it up, try to make it what it needs to be for competition.
Right.
They're getting that input from real world competitive shooters.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the starting point. And that's the type of stuff that just gets me so stoked up and excited.
That's awesome. Because Ruger's come a long way with doing a lot of stuff. You know, the whole Mark series line, now the Mark IV is out. They got all kind of stuff there. The Rimfire world has taken over Steel Challenge Shooting Association. And you see those everywhere now. And then you got people out there, you know, that are now making, you know, taking the base products of what Ruger has created and then making their own stuff around them for accessories, like, you know, Tandem Cross, everybody else, all these other outside parts manufacturers. So now that you've done what you've done with the shooting team and so many other people are coming in to grab a piece of that accessory or a piece of that pie, What do the bosses think at Ruger? Are they excited about all this, or is competition now not on the back burner anymore? It's kind of like they're seeing the innovation happen from the shooting sports.
There is, and it's kind of it's interesting. I'm a proponent of accessory stuff. One of the things I do know is good quality accessories. Let's talk to 10/22, probably the most prolific 22 caliber rifle out there. It's been around. Everybody's owned one at one time.
Yes.
And you look at what Tandem Cross can do for that.
Yes.
So you take that baseline, and somebody can start out as a newbie, entry level with our baseline 22,
mm-hmm.
Then start getting into something like what we're doing here today at Metal Madness.
Yes.
And then build up off of that. Go out there. And so that stuff sells guns for you.
Yep.
And it also leads into stop and think. We're now doing custom shop 10/22s.
Right.
So you take what people are doing. We don't go to the extreme Tandem Cross. You still want that accessory business out there because it sells product for you.
Yes.
But you start to key on the enhancements, the baseline stuff that needs to be in that gun
mm-hmm.
to make it competitive. And so it works hand in hand. So I'm a proponent of the accessory stuff. You know, you would like to think that, one would think that, you know, Ruger wants every penny they can. But at the end of the day, Ruger can't do all those accessory stuff.
That's right.
That's not what we do.
All right.
You know, we make metal and we make finished firearms.
Yep.
We don't make accessory products.
Yeah, because one of the guns I have was SR-1911.
Yeah.
I didn't do a lot with it because that other 19, one of the first 1911s I ever bought was an SR-1911 9mm. And I met Chet Whistle with CWA, and which is now Precision Performance, I think. Yeah. But he built an upper, the 22 upper for the lower that's a 1911. So it's amazing how everything just kind of comes together and has a touch of something everywhere.
Oh, we feed off each other, and that's a good thing. You start, with the Mark IV series pistols and 10/22, you know, think about just not Tandem Cross, but you mm-hmm. look at Volkwartz, and I know Scott Volkwartz very well.
Yes.
But everything is based on that initial assembly, that initial product you put out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they've tweaked it and they've taken entry level and really brought it up to that race gun type of thing, what you want to call. And there's room for all of that.
That's awesome.
And it's what we want, you know, primarily what we want is I strive to bring as many new shooters into the shooting sports. Shooting sports, I mean, it's great that someone goes out and buys a gun. So they're now a gun buyer. But if you can get them engaged in the shooting sports and go into their local range and get involved with the stuff, which teaches focus, teaches discipline, teaches firearm safety, you do all that stuff. Next thing you know, they're seeing what the guy next to them shooting.
Right.
And they want this and they want that. So then they become from gun buyers to gun owners. And then they become to that passionate gun owner who is now using that product for competition and wanting to really step up their game. Now they have choices with all the accessory companies. They can take what they started off with and start to tweak it to where they want to go. And it's great when they buy more Ruger products because they're going to continue to buy Ruger products. And, you know, take that next level up, you know, and maybe go from a 10/22 to a Mark IV series pistol or a 1911 or even like one of our striker fire pistols and stuff. So it's a progression.
Because you're a major manufacturer company that's actually on the stock market, and you made a rifle for PRS by listening to the shooting sports. That's why the shooting, a lot of people think the shooting sports is a small, it is the smallest piece of the pie that's out there when it comes to overall shooters. But your innovation for Ruger has started off listening to this 5 to 8%, whoever you talk to, of the entire industry of how to build rifles and guns on.
Yeah, that's impressive. It's voice of the customer. Ruger's big on that, which I think is absolutely a wonderful thing.
And it's, the competitive shooter is the most vocal customer you'll probably ever have.
Well, I used to tell that. I used to tell it to a lot of management at, in my older days at Smith & Wesson, and you start to look at what value does getting engaged with the competitive shooting world and competition shooting. And I tell everybody, I said, you know, we were big on demographics and doing research and studies and stuff. And so we all know we went through that period of the surge where 35% of your purchases were first-time customers. So you start doing surveys on that. You start doing that study and says, okay, how'd you make your decision? What made you decide on this brand? And it was always, well, recommendation of a friend and family. What made you go to that friend or family? Well, they're the most knowledgeable. They're the expert. So you drill down. So who is that person? That person is the guy out here on the range like today. Who has a passion for doing this stuff. He becomes that expert. So it's a waterfall effect. So you focus on those guys. You focus on what they want to play their game, to satisfy them. It all flows down from there. To that first-time shooter. So you're taking that guy up here. Who is that real hardcore gun guy enjoying the shooting sports and understand there, you start to capture their interests and you set up aspirational product that they want to shoot. Who are they going to recommend all the way down to the first time buyer? And for me, having the shooting team, I want those guys to recommend Ruger all the way down to that first time buyer.
That's awesome. And now you're involved with the Scholastic Action Shooting Program.
I am. I'm on the board of directors.
So that's a way to reach other people as well. And of course, now where we're at this weekend is MMSSA with Ed White. So we know Ruger jumped on board early, just like I did, and Tandem Cross did, and some other people. And we had a conversation that was funny over coffee this morning where, you know, Ed was amazed how all this came together. And we're sitting around going, well, Ed, we're here because of you. Ed, you gave us, you had the vision, and you brought us all on board this train. And he's like, no, we couldn't. But it's all because of that individual that brought all this together. And Ed is, everybody, you know, I had Sherry ask me, my wife goes, where are you, you know, you're going to Metal Madness again? Because usually I don't do matches back to back, unless it's big major matches and stuff like that. She's like, I said, no, Ed's done this right because he's bringing people in that have never, ever shot a gun at all in any kind of sport or anything. And what I mean by bring people in, he's got people like kids to grandparents that come shoot this. And it's a whole nother thing. So how exciting was that to you when you first heard about that?
When I first started understanding the concept of what Ed did, I was eager to jump on board with this thing because just exactly what you said. You know, Ed's bringing folks into the shooting sports, and it's a very family oriented family yep. event. You see, like you said, you see grandparents, parents, and kids there, and it's just a relaxed atmosphere, and it's unique. This is different than any other shooting sports. We, you know, there is, it's a thinking game and a speed game at the same time because of the numbering systems on there. It's, you just can't go out and just string through a thing as fast as you can.
That's right.
It forces you to think before you shoot and do that quickly.
Yep.
And it's one of the things I love about it. But you look at these young kids catching on to this and it's just, and it goes hand in hand when I see what he's doing in such a fan. And there's the way this thing is structured, a lot of people get turned off by certain shooting sports because you have guys that get so locked in, you know, the big boys that just dominate everybody and people feel intimidated to go.
Yep.
You're never going to have, the way this thing is structured, there's no king of the hill here.
Right.
Every time you shoot, it's a bracket.
Yep.
And you're just improving on yourself, and you take pride in that. And that continues to grow because it's family friendly. You see these young kids where the grandparents and parents are coming in. It teaches the kids discipline. It teaches them focus. Mm-hmm. Firearm safety. That's the big thing. It's part of why I'm it's so involved with the Scholastic Shooting Sports Foundation is that structure, you know, teaching them that focus, discipline, and safety. And that's what this does. And it's growing at an immense rate. Mm-hmm. And I told Ed way back when he was questioning himself, I said, make no mistakes. I said, you have the potential to surpass every other shooting discipline out there by what you're doing because you're appealing to such a wider base.
Yep.
And I get to be excited for Ruger. I stop and think about it. I mean, you know, one of the things that we say is as part of our mantra is we're firearms makers for responsible citizens. So it's all about the safety aspect and learning how to safely own, you know, storage and use a gun. And between Scholastic Shooting Sports Foundation, between MMSA, that's the key part of that stuff. And that's really what locks me in and focuses be such a big supporter of them.
Well, it's been huge to see. And I remember when Ed came to me and said, Ruger's really wanting to step up, do a lot more stuff. I said, man, just, I told you, this is going to get a lot bigger. Yeah. So just, there's more people coming. Just sit back and wait.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you see a lot of things with, you know, you got your finger on the pulse like I do with the shooting sports. And you see a lot of new divisions coming in. Yeah. You see a lot of, you know, PCC is blown up and Ruger's doing a PCC now. And they came out with one, two or three years back, and it's evolved.
Yeah.
It's got new things happening with the PCC, and then you see other companies coming out with, you know, not companies, other shooting sports coming out with different divisions with double stacks. So does your mind always race what's next? How can Ruger get involved?
It does. You know, the nice thing about Ruger, because we're a publicly traded company, so we don't go far outside the lines, but at the end of the day, what I tell everybody is Ruger is one of the most innovative companies that I know.
Yep.
We're always working on something. And if you're thinking about something, just wait.
just wait. Exactly. What's next for Paul? I mean, Paul, you know, you've done so much and now you're involved with it, almost like you're starting over again, being excited about the shooting sports. What's next for you? Where do you see yourself doing with this?
Like I said, Ruger's is one of the a fantastic company to work for. I'm having a lot of fun again.
Right.
They're affording me to do what I have a passion for. You know, for me, I'm going to ride it out till I retire. The problem is usually people retire because they're done working.
That's right.
This isn't work.
I know that feeling well. Yes. I work when I go back in the office Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. I'm ready to get on the road again so I can relax.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's never work when you have that much passion for it. So.
And you're doing so much now. You're doing hunting trips, you got all kind of stuff. There's just nothing stops with your you know, working with media and everybody else, because public relations is not just the shooting sports. It's If it's bad, it's bad. If it's good, it's good. You're involved in both sides of that. So
you're absolutely right. And it's kind of interesting. I mean, I go from, you know, I go from here. I got another event. Then I go take a bunch of media folks out on an Axis deer hunt because Ruger does a lot of hunting products.
Yes.
It's a mainstay. So, you know, I cover more than just the shooting sports. I have a great passion for this, obviously. So much of a passion is my current wife. I met her on a range, and I figured that—
Did you really?
I did. We were shooting a shooting I-Corps match, and when you know, I kind of noticed her and took a shine to her right away. But I figured, you know, the fact that she beat me that match, I probably should marry her. Just so I have the excuse.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So, and she travels along with you and does a lot of stuff with you too as well, right?
We do. I mean, she's awesome. You know, and so she's a certified range officer. She does a lot of, and like, I'll go to the Nationals for the Scott Shooting Sports Foundation. She goes down there and she runs stages and stuff. They utilize her.
Oh, wow.
And so it's great. So when they have me on board, it's kind of a 2-for-1. Mm-hmm. And she has such a passion for it, and she's so good at it.
You let her handle the shooting team, or you keep that to yourself still?
I kind of keep that to myself. although I will tell you, you know, like most of us, most people in the shooting team, most people I deal with like her better than me. And, yeah. I'm okay with that.
That makes sense. Do you see your shooting team growing still, or are you still kind of, you know, is more?
No, so my baseline, my core group of guys, mm-hmm. I mean, we just win everything we go at. I mean, okay. and so I have my core. So I'm at that point, I'm looking to the future. And so I got about a half a dozen juniors that right. are 16 to 18 years old.
Right.
I'm in the process of signing because that's the future. I got some kids there. I got one kid I'm looking at that has the potential to be the next Jerry Mickler.
Wow.
You know, these kids are, and you know it. You go to
yeah,
these things.
Oh, I see it. Yeah.
You see it. And these kids are, you know, they're the future of the shooting sports. They're mm-hmm. amazing. So, you know, my growth is going to bring these kids on and mm-hmm. Kind of mold them and nurture them. They have that raw ability. Mm-hmm. And the next step is how to take them and get them so focused that they have that ability to make that big leap being right. that professional shooter. But even more so, it's twofold. When you have a shooting team, they're not only competitive shooters that are using for product and winning, but they're also brand ambassadors. So,
yes.
You know, how do you mold them so they know how to handle themselves around media mm-hmm. and be that impressionable stuff? And I look at that. And it's a year ago, I brought on this girl, Annie Unsel, who was yes. big at the Scott Shoe Sports Forum.
Yes, I got a story about her. Continue.
And so Annie got a full boat scholarship to Bethel College.
Yes.
She started in there. She didn't even get through her freshman year when they said, okay, you're going to start coaching this stuff.
Right.
But she's just absolutely wonderful. And I looked at her. She not only had the raw talent, she just is one of the sweetest girls ever, but she is an absolute excellent brand ambassador.
Yeah, she's been wearing Hunter's HD Go for a while, and she shot with another team, and she called me one day and says, hey, are you in the office today? I'd like to come by and see you. I was like, yeah, sure. So, you know, I think a Monday or Tuesday, you know, her and her father came by the lab, and she looked kind of like distraught, just kind of confused, didn't know where to. I said, Annie, what's on your mind? She goes, well, I got something to tell you, but I don't want you to be, you know, upset. And I was like, what are you talking about? She goes, I'm being, you know, I think I'm going to be accepted to the Ruger shooting team. And I was like going, oh, holy cow, that's wonderful. She goes, yeah, but I don't know about the logo on the jersey. I said, Annie, let's just take 3 steps back here real quick. You're doing all this stuff with the other team you're with now. Yes, you're wearing Hunter's HD Go. That means a lot to me. And the logo, but let me just tell you something. This is all minor league stuff. You just got one of the... You're in the big leagues. This is like the next step up. And she just felt, you just saw relief go over her face like, this is okay. I said, this is why you did this with the minor leagues. We're nobody. You just got accepted by somebody who's on the stock market. This is like, there's not many companies bigger, if they are, than Ruger. This is what, so, you know, that just lets you know that's the kind of the people you're building are so humble yeah. and didn't know what to think about that. I was excited. I mean, I'm still excited for her. So.
Yeah, she's just wonderful. But I just, yes. you know, it's kind of funny you said that because there was that tension. She was really worried about that stuff. And the one thing like her and like right. all these other kids, they're very very devoted yes. and loyal to the people that they started with.
Yes.
And so I run into that all the time. I said, listen, I said, and Sam, I had that conversation probably after you talked to Annie because she said something to me. About that, I said, well, wait, you got to understand something, Annie. I said, when it comes to the jerseys,
all right.
I said, look at Doug Koenig, look at Randy Rogers, look at, mm-hmm. they all have other logos.
Yeah.
So I'm bringing you on a sponsorship. This isn't an ownership thing.
Right.
Okay. And you may not understand this. I said, but look at NASCAR. Look at that car.
Right.
Their big title sponsor may be tied,
that's
but
right.
how many other logos are on there? So this is a sponsorship thing. Yeah.
And that's what I told her. I said, look, I said, Annie, I got somebody with Glock that's wearing the lenses that can't put any logos in their jersey with Glock.
I said, they're wearing the lenses. I don't care.
Yeah. but she felt so relieved when that happened. So.
Yeah. Yeah, but at the end of the day, and I'm not, I mean, I do, they all get jerseys that are strictly have Ruger logos on it.
Yes.
So when we're doing signings or photo ops, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. But I want them, I want the world to know the quality of the people that I have shooting.
And who else believes them as well.
And yep. So I'm absolutely, you know, unless, you know, would I have them put a Glock? And I'm good friends with folks at Glock.
Right.
But would I have them put a Glock logo on a Ruger shirt? Probably not.
That doesn't make sense.
But right. I absolutely encouraging that if there is non-competing sponsors, man,
right.
Absolutely.
Right.
We want them because it's the bigger picture.
Yep. Exactly right. Well, Paul, thank you so much for sitting down with me. Is there anything we left off that you want to discuss about Ruger or anything? Or
no.
I don't want to say how can people get in touch with you because they can just, because that's a whole nother issue there with how busy you are. But, you know, if somebody wanted to be, you know, if there was people out there that you don't get to see, like in different disciplines of PRS, the hunting world or something like that, they wanted to get in touch with you about maybe being an ambassador. Is that something they go through a certain process or is that, what does that look like?
I get realms of them on a daily basis. But the good thing is somebody, usually when they get involved and they get in here, there's somebody that will say, you want to get contact with this guy here.
Okay.
For those that don't, it's pretty simplistic. Ruger's very open to the customers.
Okay.
And so there's a, you go to our website and there's a, you know, tell a CEO type of thing and contact customer service.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how many people will write into customer service and say, hey, listen, you know, I'm interested in, you know, can you tell me how to do that? That stuff instantly within minutes comes to me.
Okay.
And so there's always a way to get a hold of me.
Good.
From that.
Good.
And so anybody that's interested in that, anybody who wants to know how, and I've had conversations with young kids that say, you know, look at a Doug or a Randy and say, how do you get there from here? And I even have those guys will sit down with them. And even here, the junior shooters, part of the program with my core shooters, the pro shooters, to pay to play sort of guys. Mm-hmm. Part of that is my expectation is you're going to help develop this next generation shooter.
Nice.
Because you're not, and there are at some point in time, you know, the jury's will.
Which takes us back to Annie, because she's now, she's in charge of a whole shooting team to develop the others available as well.
Yeah. And I got to tell you, so I know a bunch of the kids that she's recruiting in Bethel.
Right.
Next year at the College Nationals.
It's going to be on.
Oh, man, it's going to be on.
Well, Texas A&M needs some pressure.
Yeah.
Because they're usually the ones that are going after.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be very interesting next year. And Annie's, she knows what she's doing. She's a great ambassador. But I got to tell you, for all the other college teams out there, they don't think about a little place like Bethel College.
Mm-hmm.
After next year, I think who I see Annie recruiting for Bethel College.
Right.
Yeah. They need to be aware that next year is going to be a different story.
That's awesome. That is wonderful to hear. Well, Paul, thanks again for sitting down with me today and, you know, and discussing your history and everything. And I'm excited. And that's one thing about it. Ruger shooting team's only been out for 6 years.
Yeah.
So it's young. There's a lot of growth there. So
I have a lot of headroom. Yeah.
You know, keep your head down, keep doing what you're doing and you're being watched.
They just
don't know they're being watched.
Yeah. Probably don't get it out because I have all my other stuff that I do, but I try to make it out to some of the, as many of these as I can. Same thing with the Scholastic Shooting Sports Foundation and stuff. And at the end of the day, you know, I quietly sit back and not everybody knows who I am. And sometimes I like that way because I get to watch these kids and I get to talk to people around them and stuff. And so Annie was a clear example of that. And go, wow, you know, this kid's got it going on. I watch how she handles herself. She's absolutely knows how to shoot. And she just watching her.
And that's what I tell people all the time too. You got to remember, be more than a shooter. What are you going to bring to the table besides just shooting? Because you got to have, you know, some kind of education or some kind of way to be able to direct the company in different ways when that time happens as well. Cause you know, a lot of people can pull the trigger, but you got to have, you know, other ways to get things done.
I remember when we were at one of the Still Nationals and Randy Rogers was there. And Randy's a phenomenal lady shooter. She wins everything. She's the queen of sass.
You put her in sass this year for the first time. That was awesome.
Well, that's where she started out with. And she owns it. She owns it. And so I remember a girl walking up to her, this kid walking up to her and say, you know, this is, she said, kid turned around. She goes, you know, how do I make a living doing this like you do? And Randy says, well, first of all, you got to understand the number of people that just do this for a living is small in between. If this is a passion, it's what you live, that you live to do. She says, I'm just going to give you this sound advice. She goes, I've always had a full-time job that allowed me to do this. She said, so very few people have the ability in this to shoot a firearm and do nothing else.
That's right.
And so it's not like football or it's not like basketball. She said, so make sure you're getting the education, make sure you're getting the structure and the discipline that affords you to focus on your passion.
Man, that makes me ask another question. There's people in other shooting sports that say they want this to be big. They want this to be on TV again. Yeah. They want this to be a sport that is recognized. From your perspective of a major firearms manufacturer that's on the stock market and everything else, do you personally think that could happen one day based on our society of 50% of the world or 50% of the United States doesn't like us?
I do.
Okay.
We're fortunate enough. So, you know, and here's the sad. And it's not just thrown it on TV. I mean, College Nationals, this classic Shooting Sports Foundation, this classic action pistol, we just had the College Nationals down in Talladega.
Yeah.
And fortunate enough to get Shooting USA, John Scout and Jim Scout.
Yep.
They came down there and filmed thing, did a lot of interviews and stuff to show what it was all about.
Right.
And so do I think that can happen again? Yeah.
Right.
I think one of the good things is do I think that we will see ABC coming down here and covering Metal Madness?
Right.
No, but the networks have kind of broken down where you have the Outdoor Channel, Pursuit Channel, Sportsman Channel, and you still see it pop up on like ESPN. And there's some local channels
right
that may be affiliated with CBS, NBC, or you know, type of stuff that will come out and cover it. Do I think that can happen? I do. We just have to make it interesting enough so that they have the story to tell.
So many, yeah, because that's what they got to have is a storyline.
Yeah.
You know, just shooting is one thing, but when you have the storyline, that's a whole nother, that's another type of reality that comes in to make a storyline behind that. So it's going to take people like the Rugers of the world to step up, because it's going to be, you know, I don't know how we get it produced or anything else, but it's going to take some big companies, some big names to do it. It's, you know, and we can't just leave it to the, you know, to the Rugers of the world, but it's going to take the major other companies to want to get behind it as well. And I think that's where the gap is right now.
I agree. I mean, my plans for next year at the Metal Madness Nationals here is I'm going to make sure we have some of our media folks in there, whether it's Guns and Ammo, whether it's, I mean, even though we may be preaching to the choir, you got to get the word out and it starts to spread. And for me, I think the best thing that could happen, because the 50% of the world that is anti-Second Amendment, I'm a proponent. It's the only reason why we're there, or they're there, is purely a lack of knowledge.
The education.
It's education.
100% agree with that statement.
And so these things like Mental Madness, like this Classic Shooting Sports Foundation, like, you know, any of the disciplines, you know, think about when you're on the range.
Yep.
You know, the whole safety aspect and all that. I mean, my wife's a prime example of that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she is locked in on safety. And ask Ed about, you know.
No, we've had some discussions already. Yes, most definitely.
And she's absolutely an incredible RO.
Mm-hmm.
But she is locked first on safety.
Yep.
And so the shooting sports, you know, everybody complains about that. A firearm is a mechanical device. I could load up a firearm, set it on a table. If that thing's not touched, I could come back in 6 years.
Didn't hurt anybody.
Didn't hurt anybody. It never went off.
That's right.
So it's not the item.
We discussed it earlier. It's our mental health system and what the economy and everything's done to people lately.
Yeah.
It's making them just flip out.
But I mean, it comes down to the point that we got to show the positive side of the shooting sports, because it does. It teaches discipline. It teaches focus. It teaches firearm safety.
100% safety.
And so at the end of the day, instead of trying to eliminate it, because firearms aren't going away. They're just, they've been manufactured for the last couple hundred years. There's always going to be firearms out there. The guys that are using them wrongly, you know, that's what you got to correct.
Right.
Because they're not going away. So the best thing that people could hope for is to support what we're doing here, because every one of these people you watch, even the little kids, you watch how they handle a gun. You know, they're the first one to call somebody out if they see something unsafe.
Yep.
And that's what this
when you have kids calling out adults, that's pretty good.
It is.
But in a good way.
In a good way.
Because we sometimes as adults, we get complacent.
We do.
And we need when you realize you got junior shooters watching you more because you are an adult, that's a good thing.
And I'm always amazed when I go anything where they have a lot of youth there, I'm much more comfortable there because I watch these kids and how because they've learned it right. Mm-hmm. And I watch how disciplined they are, how safety conscious they are. You know that when they're learning this, doing things like Metal Madness,
right?
That's what they're learning, and that's the future. That's what it's all about.
Man, that's awesome. Paul, congratulations on all your success.
Well, I appreciate that.
I'm very excited to see what's next with Ruger and what's around the corner. We're going to be doing a lot of stuff with Hunters HD Gold and Ruger as well, so I've got a lot of plans there in the future. And if you have any questions for Paul, you know, feel free to reach out to me at info@huntershdgold.com, and I will personally forward that email to Paul and get all some questions answered. But, Paul, thanks again for sitting down with me today and being a part of just Hunters HD Gold, what you're doing with us. I appreciate it.
I appreciate it, too. And listen, I can tell you, for anybody that is even considered Hunters HD Gold, if you want to know the quality and if you should own one of them, just ask my wife. She'll be the first to tell you that, you know, don't mess with her 100 gold glasses because she gets upset because that is her prize. So
thank you so much.
I do appreciate you taking care of, you know, making sure she had the right setup on there. So
no, you're very welcome. It's all a big family. And when you get all the manufacturers together, like we do at so many different events, to be able to put all the pieces together to see we're all on the same page of growing the shooting sports and growing the industry. That's what it's all about. So I'm glad there's people like you out there that have the history to go out there and have the fight right there at your doorstep so you can make our freedoms even easier or not easier, but more secure for the future. So thanks for all you've done with that as well.
I thank you, and thank you for all your support on stuff, because at the end of the day, you know, this the shooting sports growing the knowledge is what's going to turn a lot of things around for the firearms industry. So once again, my friend, thank you very much.
Very cool. Thank you again for watching or listening to this episode of Hunters HD Gold Behind the Lens, and until next time, we'll see you at the range soon. Thanks again, Paul.
Thank you.
For a complete written transcript of the Dr. Bill Show, go online to www.icarusmusic.com.
And welcome back to the Dr. Bill Show. Let's go to a caller who seems to be having issues communicating with his girlfriend. Caller?
Yeah, I'd had this problem with my girlfriend. She kind of broke up with me. I've been doing everything right. Everything's been going great. We went out. We've gone out for, I don't know, I'd say a good 5-6 months. Everything's good. I mean...
But, son, you've got to use communication.
I've done that. I mean, what else can I do? I mean, seriously, I mean, like, I...
Son. Some girls are just bitches.